This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
And with that, it is midnight in New York City, and you are tuned to listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI, 99.5 FM. That was a rebroadcast of the evening news, con su edición en español, informativo. And what's coming up next should be this. Moorish, Orthodox, Radio, Crusade, Anarchism for the Global City, Radical Environmentalism for the Concrete Jungle, Esoteric Explorations of the Secret History of Rebel Culture, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there. All right, opening up with some music here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM with me, Bill Weinberg, and some special guests who will be introduced shortly. That was from the album Si Soy Llanero, Joropo music from the Orinoco Plains of Colombia from Smithsonian Folkways. And that featured Hugo Molina on the bandola. And boy, can that guy play the bandola. And actually, the Orinoco Plains are bisected by the border between Colombia and Venezuela. And it's an extremely oil-rich region, also a very contested region. And many listeners will probably be aware that Exxon recently pulled out of its contracts on the Venezuelan side of the border in the Orinoco Plains because they didn't like the deal which they were being offered by the populist government of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Whereas on the Colombian side, Occidental Petroleum has got a very sweet deal and is working hand in glove with the Colombian military against the guerrillas in the region who keep blowing up the pipeline. And The Colombian government accuses Hugo Chavez of Venezuela of backing the guerrillas, and Hugo Chavez, in turn, accuses the Colombian government of backing paramilitaries who are infiltrating into Colombia to destabilize his government. So it's a battle line which has been drawn across the continent, which concerns these are some of the richest oil reserves in the world, as a matter of fact, possibly the richest outside of the Persian Gulf. And joining us to talk about these and other matters is, once again, a year later, Nicholas Kozlov. Welcome back to these airwaves.
Gracias, Bill.
De nada. Bienvenido. And your new book is Revolution with an exclamation mark, South America and the Rise of the New Left. Hot off the presses from Palgrave Macmillan.
Yes, indeed.
And we had you on these airwaves a year ago to discuss your book, which came out, was it last year or the year before?
Well, it originally came out in 2006. I think it went into paperback around about the time that I came on your show last time.
Uh-huh. And that was a sort of a political biography of Hugo Chavez.
To a certain extent, it did discuss many of the personal details of Chavez and his rise on the political scene, but also dealt with the larger kind of politics between the United States and Venezuela and how it deteriorated. And this next book, while it deals with Venezuela, it's much broader than that. I deal with Venezuela as well as the many other South American countries and how they're taking a independent course, freer of the United States.
Right, and sort of, well, to put it in perhaps slightly loaded terms, exporting the Venezuelan Revolution to much of the rest of the continent.
Well, right, and I think that certainly Venezuela, which wasn't particularly well known to many Americans, has kind of leapt onto the geopolitical stage. I personally think that maybe Venezuela hit its zenith as far as the geopolitical influence, maybe 2005, 2006, and the beginning of 2007. I think maybe what we're seeing now is maybe the limit to what to the Chavez project in wider South America, and I think that's explainable in a number of different ways. For example, I think some South American countries might look at the U.S. presidential election and figure that, well, if Obama gets in there, then we don't necessarily want to attach our coattails to Chavez to such a degree because we're not sure if we want to alienate the United States. Certainly, you know, as I discuss in the book, you know, Chavez's reach is quite impressive in countries such as Bolivia, for example.
Right. Well, I mean, there's sort of mixed signals because on one hand, and we'll discuss this in greater depth shortly, you know, Chavez has met with certain political reversals in terms of his trying to extend his
personalistic power, shall we say, through the state apparatus in Venezuela. But on the other hand, in terms of the continent-wide project, you could argue that his influence, or at least the influence of the political bloc or tendency which he represents, has only grown dramatically over the course of the past couple of years. Because now not only Bolivia, but Ecuador, it seems, has joined the anti-imperialist bloc, so to speak.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up the case of Ecuador. I'm not sure I entirely agree with you on that, because I don't know if you saw just a few days ago, Ecuador has rejected the Bolivarian alternative to the Americas, known as ALBA, which is Chavez's plan to encourage reciprocity and solidarity among South American nations and perhaps boost trade outside of the usual corporate strictures and the free trade promoted by the United States. And just a few days ago, Ecuador said no. So I think that might represent a ceiling on Chavez's geopolitical influence. While I'm not denying what you're saying, I think that some of the smaller countries like Ecuador may be a little averse to joining in with the Bolivarian alternative for the Americas for some of the reasons that I mentioned before. For example, this pending U.S. election, and Ecuador maybe doesn't know how it's going to turn out. Perhaps if Obama gets in there, then Ecuador doesn't want to be seen as too closely allied to Chavez. That said, yes, I mean, if you consider South America in 2002 and now in 2008, Chavez projected his power to an unbelievable degree.
Right. It's unrecognizable.
And certainly in Bolivia, which I visited in the course of my investigations for this book, the Venezuela-Cuba-Bolivia alliance is really quite innovative, to say the least. I went, for example, to interview the Cuban ambassador in La Paz, and he told me all about how Cuban doctors had fanned out all over Bolivia and the details of this emerging alliance between Cuba and Bolivia. And that's really striking for me, because when you consider that in 1967, Ernesto Che Guevara was killed in Bolivia, hunted down by the Central Intelligence Agency, and Cuba and Bolivia were not exactly on great terms then. It's really remarkable to consider that now Venezuela, Bolivia, and Cuba have this tight alliance. That's certainly quite a novel development on the geopolitical stage. Whether or not, this bloc of Cuba, Bolivia, and Venezuela on its own can really move progressive politics forward in South America and represent a significant bloc, remains to be seen. I think that it's encouraging, but these are smaller countries, relatively speaking, although Venezuela obviously has disproportionate influence because of the oil.
Right, and Bolivia's got a lot of natural gas as well. It's remarkable when you think that just 30 years ago, and Bolivia was literally run by Nazis, right? I mean, Klaus Barbie was the butcher of Leon, was the head of the intelligence services there, and today they've got an indigenous president, the first indigenous president in South America. It's quite remarkable, the change which we've witnessed just in the past generation.
Right.
But I should say, every time, that you say, maybe we'll have a President Obama next year, I feel like I should say knock on wood or ojalá. And by the way, I should also mention that also joining us tonight is Marisol Ruiz, who teaches Spanish at the Brecht Forum, or the Marxist School here in New York City. Welcome aboard. Bienvenido, Marisol.
Buenos días a los radio escucha. Good morning to everybody.
Good morning. I still think of it as night. Para mí es la mañana cuando podemos ver el sol en el cielo. Para mí no voy a dormir hasta muchas horas todavía, y por eso todavía es noche de martes y no la mañana de miércoles. But Mary Saul, do you happen to know what a bandola is? What kind of a musical instrument that is?
I have no idea.
You're from Panama originally.
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm.
So not too far, actually, from where this music was recorded, bordering Colombia anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
And a lot of Colombian cultural influences. Actually, it was part of Colombia until an act of U.S. gunboat diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. 1903.
So are you in touch with friends and family back at home?
Yes, I am.
And do you have a sense of how they view Hugo Chavez, if I may take the liberty of asking?
No, I have no idea how they feel about him.
Okay.
No, sorry.
But, you know, interestingly enough, and I've written a decent amount about this, in Central America, Chavez has been able to recruit a lot of key allies. And, for example, in Nicaragua, and now next March, we're going to have an election in El Salvador, which according to the polls, could bring the FMLN, which is the left party in El Salvador, which for many years struggled militarily against the U.S. Now it looks like the FMLN might come to power through the ballot box, and that stands to benefit Chavez because the FMLN has had ties to Chavez at the local municipal level. You know, Chavez has shipped oil to these FMLN mayors in El Salvador. And so currently the FMLN candidate, Mauricio Funes, who's kind of this media-savvy guy who's had a show on Salvador national television for many years, it looks like he could actually win. And so I think that Chavez, if Nicaragua, El Salvador have left-wing presidents, we could see Chavez extending his influence yet further. Again, though, I just want to say that many of these countries are small and impoverished, and I think we have to look to maybe some of the larger countries like Brazil and some of the others, which may be less progressive, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And you visited all of these countries for your new book, Revolution, South America and the Rise of the New Left, and spoke with activists, academics, officials, and thinkers and observers in Venezuela and Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, Brazil. What am I leaving out?
Yeah, well, I didn't go to Central America for this book, but I went to Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, Brazil. It was sort of a marathon tour, lasting 2 months, and I interviewed people from across the political spectrum, it was really eye-opening. It was, I think, we're in a unique period right now in South American politics. I think South America, in many ways, is a laboratory for left progressive ideas in a way that a lot of other regions of the world just aren't. For example, you look at Africa, the only country that's, for me, not that I'm an expert maybe in Africa, but the only country I think that maybe is remotely kind of on the progressive side is South Africa. I don't see much else going.
Some people would argue Zimbabwe, but probably don't want to get into that right now.
And Europe, Asia, not to mention North America, don't really seem to be in the vanguard of progressive politics right now. And so South America is really a laboratory, a vehicle for a lot of the social forces that are coming to the fore, which were repressed in the 1960s, but which are now playing increasingly more important role in government in South America, but also, you know, outside government, pressuring governments to move to the left. So in this book, I kind of trace the contours of this new leftist movement in South America. I look at, for example, the energy politics, how the military has been transformed, because a lot of people in the U.S. have this view that South American militaries are repressing the people, and that was certainly true perhaps 30 years ago, but now The South American militaries have been transformed, the whole institution of the military from Venezuela, even to Chile, is more allied to the ideological projects of these new regimes. And I also discuss other aspects of the new left movement, for example, the social movements, the cultural component, which I think is really necessary in terms of an understanding of the politics of the region. I also talk about the media, which is increasingly less favorable to the United States. And then, you know, I talk about how this hemispheric integration, which is taking place, is probably going to take a progressive turn, although it's still a bit muddled at the moment. So it's probably the most comprehensive book on the subject. 2 months of interviews, and it's probably the most systematic look at the whole phenomenon that's sweeping the continent.
Now, when did you actually do the traveling and the interviews?
This was April. March and April of 07.
Mm-hmm. So, another country, again, not one of the major players in Latin America, but still another country which has gone to the left since then is Paraguay.
Well, right. Speaking of Nazis, you
yes, exactly.
Mentioned that earlier. For many years, the dictator of Paraguay, Alfredo Stroessner, was known for harboring former Nazis. And so in light of that fact, it's really remarkable that now we're going to have a former, actually, archbishop. I think he's the first bishop or archbishop to become president of a country, as far as I know. So Fernando Lugo, who's known as Bishop of the Poor, has made some complimentary remarks about Chavez's political accomplishments. And so this is the latest country to kind of shift to the more progressive left. And I think what we're going to see is that there may be a battle for hearts and minds now between Venezuela and Brazil for the allegiance of these smaller countries. Publicly, Brazil and Venezuela are allies, and President Lula of Brazil and Chavez of Venezuela pat each other on the back during these summit meetings, and there's all kinds of energy agreements between the two countries. But I think that in an era of waning, maybe not waning U.S. influence, but lesser U.S. influence, I think we may see a battle for hearts and minds for the allegiance of these smaller countries. And I think Chavez would like to promote his Bolivarian alternative for the Americas, which is this very innovative scheme that brings, you know, Cuban doctors to Bolivia and barters oil for cattle and between Venezuela and Argentina, for example. Brazil, on the other hand, has a different development project, economic development, different ideas about economic development. So I think that some of these smaller countries like Ecuador, Paraguay may look to Venezuela and try to figure out, well, what advantages can I secure from Chavez? What can Brazil give to me? And so the geopolitical situation right now is a little muddled. You know, nevertheless, though, I think that within 10, 15 years, we are going to have hemispheric integration in South America. There's about, you know, 10 governments in the region, all of a leftist progressive stripe. And so I think inevitably there will be hemispheric integration. The only question is it going to take a more progressive, contour stripe like Chavez would like, or is it going to be a bit more moderate as Brazil is pushing currently?
Well, you've got a very alliterative chapter title, Pingüinos Piquiteros and the PT, the PT being the Workers' Party of Brazil, which is the party of President Luiz Inácio da Silva, or Lula. And you actually have very unflattering things to say about Lula and the PT. You sort of portray them as having, rhetoric aside, capitulated to the neoliberal agenda.
Well, yes, I'm a bit skeptical of President Lula in this book. That said, though, because the politics of the region is so fluid and dynamic and fast-moving, since the publication of this book, I wouldn't say that I go back on what I said in the book, but I think that Lula's second term in office as president is not as bad as his first term. I mean, in the first term, he basically capitulated to international financial capital, and he did the bidding of international financial institutions. And I think that to a certain extent that's still true in a second term, but I think that poverty has gone down in Brazil, and, you know, he's pretty popular right now, according to the polls, and I think somewhat deservedly so. It's true, I did have a somewhat cynical take in the book, I think maybe the verdict may be still out on his second term.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised the degree to which he still maintains the support of the landless movement in Brazil, the MST, in spite of his seeming betrayals and a certain degree of repression against the MST's land occupations and that sort of thing.
Well, right. And it's always, although a lot of these people from the PT or the labor movement and the landless movement, they have representation in government. And so that's what I find so striking about a lot of the politics in South America right now. It's not always clearly discernible the difference between the government and outside activism. For example, in Bolivia, Evo Morales's party is, you might say it's not a conventional political party. It's more of maybe a social instrument. It's a loose conglomeration of social movements. And I think to a large extent, South American countries are trying to reconfigure politics, the relationship between the state and outside social forces. And I think that that's what's really dynamic about and which drew me to the subject.
Mm. Well, the MST doesn't, I mean, it's not a, it doesn't function as a political party the way Evo Morales says MAS does, the movement towards socialism. I mean, am I wrong? It doesn't actually have people, you know, who run on the MST ticket and that sort of thing.
I mean, right. But I think they have
some land occupations.
But I think they have some members of the former MST are now government officials in Lula's cabinet, and so there's a fluid dynamic between the two. Mm-hmm. Whether or not Lula adheres to social justice in the countryside is another matter, but I think Brazil and many of these countries are trying to they use the phrase refound the state.
Yes.
As in the case of Bolivia, mm-hmm. to rethink how the state works and its relationship to civil society.
Mm-hmm. Marisol, how's your Portuguese? I know you speak many languages. Is Portuguese among them?
Yes.
So how do you
but
say?
But I'm not fluent.
Uh-huh. But fluent enough to tell us what the correct translation of MST would be, the landless movement?
No, I don't know what that means.
Movimiento Sem...
without land.
Right, but
yeah.
How do you say it? Movimento Sem Terra, I believe?
Movimento Sem Terra,
yeah,
I
there
think.
You go. Pretty close. Okay, so that's the PT. What are pingüinos?
The pingüinos are high school students in Chile. They're called the penguins because of their uniforms, that they wear these blue blazers, hence their nickname. And you know, students have always been the vanguard of radical politics in Chile, going back to even the Allende period. I think in the book I cite how one of Allende's first speeches was given from the balcony of a of I think the City University in Santiago. During the Allende regime, I guess 1970 to 1973, many students came to Chile, impressed by some of the progressive policies espoused by Allende. Today, it's not so much college students, interestingly enough, but the high school students that are really pushing politics forward in Chile. They had initially, just some local grievances about the state of high school, the state of education, but then they increasingly have taken on other issues like the deplorable state of transportation in Santiago. And so it looked for a while as if maybe these pingüinos, ironically enough, these high school students, might be the vehicle for greater social organization in Chile. I don't know if that will turn out to be the case. I went to interview a guy named Manuel Cavieses, who's a veteran of many political struggles in Santiago. He's the director of a political newspaper called Punto Final. And as he explained to me, social forces are atomized. That was the word that he used in Chile. Under the Pinochet dictatorship, the organized left was almost destroyed. And so I think it's going to take a long time for the progressive forces to regroup in Chile. Nevertheless, there are encouraging signs. For example, the pingüinos, for one, and then some, and then the Mapuche Indians in the countryside that are pushing social justice in the countryside. Whether or not these disparate groups can come together, form a more cohesive political force pushing for change remains to be seen. But I think that in Chile we may have seen the zenith or nadir of this economic model of free trade, which definitely encouraged growth for many years, but now is not encouraging that same level of growth, and as a result, we may see more social protest. Maybe not the level of Bolivia, but Bolivia is a hard act to follow. I mean, Bolivia has the most radical social movements on the continent. But Chile is getting there. And so I think there's just a cauldron of these social movements all over South America, and they're pushing governments to take a more progressive stance.
Okay, I should say that it is 12:32 in the morning on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg. We're speaking with Nicholas Kozloff, author of Revolution, with an exclamation mark, South America and the Rise of the New Left. And we're also joined by Marisol Ruiz, who teaches Spanish at the Marxist School here in New York City. Okay, Nick, that was pingüinos. What are piqueteros?
The piqueteros are a very novel political force in on the Argentine scene. To address your question, I think we need to go back to 2001 when Argentina was hit by an economic collapse, there were many unemployed people. Some unemployed workers undertook innovative political strategy of actually blocking roads in an effort to get social benefits from the state or increased employment. Actually what you found in Argentina was that these picoteros, at least in the first few years, I think, really inspired many other Argentines who actually sympathized, because the middle class was also very hard hit by the financial collapse, which was brought on by the International Monetary Fund, large financial institutions. Over the past few years, these picoteros have somewhat are less visible. Some of them have actually joined the government. And I think that President Kirchner, Nestor Kirchner, and now his wife, who's now President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, have been very effective at absorbing the independent political strength of the Picatero movement and sort of co-opting them into government. Nevertheless, I do think that the Picatero struggle has made a psychological impact on Argentine society, and I don't think Argentina, by any stretch of the imagination, resembles the same society that we saw in the 1990s, the go-go days of Carlos Menem, when much of, you know, Argentine business was privatized, and you had free market reforms. I think, the Picateros, and others, have transformed politics in Argentina, just has no resemblance to the country that it once was. And now Argentina is one of the key allies of Venezuela in South America, which has an impact on South American politics, but potentially on the world stage, if Venezuela and Argentina can constitute a larger bloc of countries that could, you know, rival Brazil and Brazil's idea of development for the region.
And we should say, I suppose, Picatero is it's an Anglicism. That's a reference to the picket lines, right?
Right. Yeah. But it's not when you hear that word picket, you may think, oh, a picket like in the U.S. labor movement where they picket Ford Motor Company or something and they don't allow workers to go into the plant. And this is a different concept. It's a picket, but you're closing down roads. You're shutting down traffic.
And in some cases, actually taking over the factories. I mean, there are factories which are run by the Picateros now.
Right.
You stayed at a hotel which was run by Picateros.
Right. I actually went to this hotel. It's called the Hotel Bowen. It's in Buenos Aires. It was taken over by workers following the financial collapse. One of the interesting things about this hotel is that a lot of Venezuelans go to stay there. And so this hotel is quite popular amongst, other workers coming from outside of Buenos Aires. So they stay there out of solidarity. I guess you could say a Hotel Bowen is a radical hotel. This is just one example amongst many. There's another ceramics factory called Zanon, which is quite famous. The example of the Argentine example has inspired other workers in Venezuela to develop their own worker-owned factories. And there's been a whole exchange. I mean, I talked to a guy named Andres Ruggeri in the book. We had an interview in the Hotel Bowen itself, and he's an academic, but he's gone on these conferences to Venezuela where he talks about the Argentine experience to Venezuelans, and they share this information. And so this seems to be catching on. In Brazil, you have some other worker-owned factories as well. I think that's definitely a very inspiring example of innovative worker strategies.
Okay, well, the Picateros have pushed Argentina to the left, as you say, but I would still say that the Kirchner dynasty is closer to the moderate left block around Lula, and Brazil and Chile, rather than to the more radical bloc around Hugo Chavez and Venezuela and Bolivia. Would you agree?
I think Argentina is playing a very delicate game of geopolitics. I think that Argentina, just for historical reasons, doesn't like Brazil running the show in the Southern Cone. Mm-hmm. They're rivals historically. And so I think maybe by backing Venezuela's bid to join Mercosur, which is this trade bloc in South America, perhaps Argentina hopes to offset Brazilian influence.
By backing who's?
There's this trade bloc, which is now becoming increasingly a political bloc, it seems, in South America called Mercosur.
Mm-hmm.
Venezuela put in a bid to join this trade bloc, and then sort of, and I think Chavez's strategy is to transform Mercosur from a kind of free trade bloc and to add a more political dimension to it, to add more progressive politics into the equation. Argentina backed Venezuela's bid to join Mercosur, and I think that's kind of a snub in the face of Brazil, which may have been a bit more wary about Chavez joining in Mercosur, but Argentina has voted for Venezuela to join. And this has been held up in Brazil because there are right-wing parties in the Brazilian parliament that want nothing to do with Chavez. They don't want Venezuela to join Mercosur.
Well, isn't Mercosur, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I thought that it was sort of a regional southern cone sort of thing, and Venezuela is up at the other end of the continent. I mean, is that one of the arguments which is being made?
Yeah, well, traditionally it's been a southern cone, right? Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay, Argentina, I think Chile is an associate member, whatever that. Yeah, you might say geographically it's a little odd for Venezuela to be joining this, but I think, you know, Chavez has said, look, I am not a huge admirer of this free trade model, and Mercosur, even though it's not free trade inspired by the United States, it's still just essentially just free trade among South American countries, and we can do better than that. We can transform Mercosur into something that transforms people's lives in a more progressive direction. So I'm not sure whether economically it makes much sense for Venezuela to join, but because, you know, some industries, like, for example, cheese, believe it or not. This is what I heard when I was in Venezuela. The cheesemakers or the dairy industry would not stand to benefit if Venezuela joined this larger trade bloc. So there are economic contradictions there.
Could they be flooded with cheap cheese from Argentina?
I'm not sure from which country, but this is what I heard. But I think, nevertheless, that might be offset by political considerations. In other words, Chavez might think, well, maybe economically this is not such, we may not benefit in every sense of the word, but politically, if I join these other countries, then I can subvert it from within.
All right. So does he hope to turn Mercosur into a vehicle for ALBA, the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas?
Yes. Right now, you have these contradictory proposals on the table. You have Mercosur, you have the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, and I think the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas has stalled, as I explained earlier, because Ecuador wants nothing to do with it, which is a big blow, because it looked as if President Correa of Ecuador was the latest member of the Pink Tide sweeping South America. He was a protege of Chavez, who had flown to Venezuela to meet with Chavez before the Ecuadorian election in 2006 or 2007. And now it looks like maybe we're seeing a ceiling on this kind of Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas. Yes, Chavez has been able to cultivate ties with Dominica, a small island in the Caribbean, Nicaragua, and Bolivia, but these are smaller countries. And I think I'm just not sure whether I think that the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas makes sense maybe in a social sense. I'm not sure whether it's actually increased trade or whether a lot of people view it as a realistic mechanism to promote economic development.
Well, if I can just ask, what was the actual mechanism by which ALBA was defeated in Ecuador? Did Correa turn against
Correa it? Correa announced that Ecuador would just not participate.
Argument?
I haven't followed exactly what his argument was. I would imagine that there was different reasons, perhaps even behind the scenes. I think, as I explained earlier, I think Ecuador may be watching the U.S. election and thinking, well, if Obama wins, then we don't want to be identified with this radical project coming out of Venezuela. Maybe let's just wait a few more months and see what happens. Also, I think that there is a pretty strong right wing. I didn't really talk about the right wing in South America too much in this book. It deals mostly with the left, but, you know, that said, there is a pretty vibrant and strong right wing in Ecuador, based mostly in the coastal city of Guayaquil, where Jaime Nabat, the mayor of Guayaquil, holds sway. And I think that President Correa has to worry about being too closely identified with Chavez for domestic reasons, because he doesn't want to be demonized by the media in Ecuador. So I think that's a possible explanation. It's somewhat speculative, but I think that might have been the reason.
Okay. Well, I should say that it's now 15 minutes of the hour, being 1 o'clock, which makes it 12:45, here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Once again, this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. I'm Bill Weinberg, and we're speaking with Nicholas Kozloff, author of the book Revolution, South America and the Rise of the New Left, which is published by Palgrave Macmillan. Was Palgrave some kind of a subsidiary specializing in political affairs, world political affairs?
They do a lot of political books, and they publish books on Latin America, but also U.S. politics, and I think they do some good work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, continuing with your alliterative theme on the chapter titles, the chapter immediately before Pingüinos, Piquiteros, and the Peite is the Poncho Revolution. Can you tell us what you mean by the Poncho Revolution?
Well, as I was saying before, I think the most radical social movements on the South American continent can be found right now in Bolivia. And so by Poncho, I mean indigenous people, which... and the poncho has now become a cultural symbol. And so ponchos are prominently displayed. Evo Morales himself, President Evo Morales, according to a historian who I interviewed in La Paz, didn't used to wear a poncho, but now he is. And so I think in Bolivia, the progressive politics is definitely taking on a very, very strong cultural component, and strongly identified with, you know, clothing, for example, but also coca leaf. And in that sense, Chavez actually played a pretty big role in promoting this coca leaf. And I think in that sense, he's solidified Venezuelan Bolivian ties by playing up coca leaf. He himself said that he had chewed coca paste. I think he made a mistake at one point. He said that people interpreted it as he was sniffing cocaine, but what he really meant was that he chewed coca leaf.
Right,
yeah.
Right. I mean, there's three phases. There's a coca leaf, which is the stuff which actually grows out of the ground, and then it's turned into paste, and then the paste is refined into the finished product, cocaine.
Right. But Chavez himself has financed some of these coca, these factories that produce coca products. And in Bolivia, they make coca toothpaste,
right.
They make coca tea, a lot of products made out of coca.
Right. And, of course, you know, they're attempting to de-emphasize the connection with cocaine.
Right.
Right.
And Morales would say, look, I'm collaborating with the drug war, you know, although there are certain areas of the country where you can farm coca legally.
Right. But
this has been a source of great tension with Washington.
Right. And Morales, he was a coca grower. That's where he began, as a leader of the coca growers.
Right. And I think... I think that may ingratiate himself amongst with President Lula. I make the point in the book that a lot of the present leaders of South America came up through progressive movements, and so Lula in Brazil was in the labor movement and was actually jailed on a couple of different occasions. Morales was also in the labor movement in the coca growers union in Bolivia, was jailed. There have been some disagreements between Brazil and Bolivia over it has to do with energy, the energy politics of the region. I go into it in the book. But they've been able to smooth over their differences, and I suggest that that may have something to do with the fact that these two leaders both came up through labor, and they may, you know, see somewhat eye to eye whatever their domestic political considerations might be.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you want to read more about pingüinos, piquiteros, the Pété, and the Poncho Revolution, once again, check out Revolution, South America and the Rise of the New Left by Nicholas Kozloff. I should also mention that you have a piece on my website, World War IV Report. You have the lead story this month, which is rather provocatively entitled, Enough with the Hugo Chavez Hero Worship. And your subtitle is, Time for the Left to Repudiate Venezuelan Leader Over China While Supporting the Goals of the Bolivarian Revolution. I was just wondering if you've received any feedback or criticism over sort of coming out publicly with this stance.
Disappointingly silent, actually. I haven't heard much. I have had discussion with some people in the field of, people who follow Venezuelan politics. Sometimes what people will say is, you can't have a foreign policy that's necessarily based on human rights. I personally think that that's a very slippery slope, and that's why I wrote that article for your website. Though I have, over the past few years gone on progressive media as well as right-wing media in this country, defending many of the accomplishments of Chavez, I think I have a serious disagreement about his attitude towards China. And I said so in the article. So I don't think, just because you agree with the Bolivarian Revolution doesn't necessarily mean that you have to agree with everything that Chavez says or everything about his foreign policy.
Well, I'll point out that the notion that you can't base a foreign policy on human rights is precisely what is advocated by the right wing in this country. I mean, the whole notion of a human rights-based foreign policy was put forth by Jimmy Carter and was viewed as a complete disaster because it only led to the destabilization of Nicaragua and the near destabilization of El Salvador. And the U.S. essentially, losing ground, especially in Latin America, but also on the global stage with Iran and Afghanistan, that same fateful year of 1979. And the whole notion of a foreign policy based on human rights was overturned in the Reagan era. So, now I'm not saying that, and I'm not making an uncritical analogy here because, the U.S. was, basing its realpolitik Reagan era foreign policy on extending and or preserving U.S. hegemony, whereas Hugo Chavez is sort of adopting, it would seem, a realpolitik foreign policy predicated towards breaking U.S. hegemony. So I understand this is a very critical difference, but even so, I think that it's it should give us pause anyway.
Right, right. And just to back up, in the article, basically I criticized Chavez for defending China's crackdown in Tibet. In the article I talk about how Venezuela's extended ties to China, China has been industrializing. And people may consider Venezuela a chief oil-producing nation, it also produces steel, for example. And so steel is a hugely important commodity in terms of industrialization. And so China's been gobbling up, raw materials from Venezuela to all over South America. Chavez says that he wants to create this multipolar world that would represent a break on U.S. hegemony. And I certainly understand that, but I think, as I say in the article, I think he goes too far when he says that the United States is responsible for everything that happens in Tibet, and that the United States is trying to derail the Olympics in China by provoking unrest in Tibet. And I think that does a disservice to Tibetans. I think the Tibetans have their own struggle. I don't think that the Tibetans are controlled by the United States. I wouldn't be surprised if the United States has encouraged Tibetan unrest maybe in the past. I've read that definitely occurred.
Certainly,
the
CIA backed Tibetan guerrillas in the 1950s.
Right, in the 50s.
A long time ago.
Right, right. And so I think that was definitely, for me at least, a low moment in the Chavez rhetoric. But this is also part and parcel of his foreign policy. You know, going back even before the Iraq War, he went to Iraq. He met with Saddam Hussein prior to the invasion. I was one of the few, or maybe the only, world leader to do so at that time. And then after the war, he's cultivated ties to such figures as Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in Iran, and he calls Ahmadinejad, I think the quote was something like, great man of peace or something really ludicrous. And also he's extended ties to Alexander Lukashenko of Belarus, a total tyrant who has a secret police force, which is still called the KGB, which rounds up, disappears people, criminalizes social protest. So in the article, I'm basically pointing this out, and I'm saying, look, the left should look at, should certainly respect and encourage many of the accomplishments of the Bolivarian Revolution, but this goes too far. I think that this is a contradiction. If Chavez supposedly espouses progressive principles, then what is he doing backing Chinese crackdown in Tibet? It's a rather disappointing contradiction.
And if I could just take the point a little bit further, it might also speak to some of the authoritarian measures he's attempted to implement at home. The two most recent ones he's actually backed off on in the face of opposition. The attempt to reconfigure the intelligence services, making citizen informants and collaboration with the intelligence services mandatory. And then the earlier referendum, which would have put a great deal of decree power in presidential hands, which was defeated at the polls back in December, I believe it was.
Right, and I think that some of these smaller countries like Ecuador that I was talking about before, they may look at what domestic political developments in Venezuela and see how Chavez is getting turned back in terms of his extension of power. And so they may think, well, do we really want to attach coattails to Venezuela, perhaps Chavez at the zenith of his power, but perhaps his star is now fading somewhat, and we don't necessarily want to be so closely identified with this.
Okay. Now, you say that there has been resounding silence to your story. Enough with the Hugo Chavez hero worship. Time for the left to repudiate Venezuelan leader over China while supporting goals of the Bolivarian Revolution, by Nicholas Kozloff on World War IV Report. You say there's been largely silence, but we could correct this condition immediately in one fell swoop by inviting the listeners to give us a call at 212-209-2900. Do we choose to do this, Nicholas?
Well, let's see what people think.
Okay. Should we hear a little bit more Llanero music and give people a chance to call in and at 212-209-2900 and speak with Nicholas Kozloff, author of Revolution, South America, and the Rise of the New Left, hot off the presses from Palgrave Macmillan. We'll take your phone calls right after a brief musical break. 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, where it is mere seconds of midnight. Okay, let's hear some more Jarocho music. Quintero on the harp with a track called Zumba Que Zumba. Mary Soul, can you translate that? What does Zumba Que Zumba mean? Oh, it's Zumba Que Zumba. And once again, that
sounds a little idiomatic.
I think it's very idiomatic,
yeah.
Yes. They actually do offer a translation, but I was just wondering if Mary Soul knows what the word Zumba means. Definitely idiomatic, from the great plains of the Orinoco Basin of Colombia and Venezuela. From the album Si, Soy Llanero, Joropo music from the Orinoco Plains of Colombia, from Smithsonian Folkways 2004. Okay, do you know that word, Zumba, Mary Soul? Just out of curiosity.
Zumba que zumba is usually used is more onomatopoeic than anything else.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Zumba que zumba. It doesn't really mean anything specific.
Hmm.
It's just a sound.
Right. But this, yeah. But what does the sound signify? I mean, zumba is not a sound which particularly occurs in nature, or it just sort of sounds like what it is. Zumba.
Zumba.
It certainly,
zumba is zumba.
It exudes exuberance. Yes. Okay, so we're going to take some phone calls, right? 212-209-2900. If anybody wants to weigh in on the question of whether or not it is time for the left in New York City and the United States and the Western Hemisphere and the world to say enough with the Hugo Chavez hero worship and support the goals of the Bolivarian Revolution in terms of breaking free from U.S. hegemony and redistributing the wealth and imposing some public control on the oil companies and the mechanisms of global capitalism, while still having some principled criticisms of human rights betrayals, particularly vis-a-vis China, Iran, Belarus, etc. So I'm sure people will have something to say about this. 212-209-2900. Now, before we played the music, we had three people calling in. Now we only have two people calling in. And we don't take phone calls when we... Okay, there's three. Okay, let's give it a shot. Okay, because we only take phone calls when we have three people calling in. That's the bare minimum by which we will delve into the unknown. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, I think the left in the United States, rather than breaking away from Hugo Chavez, I think that he has to be allowed and encouraged and supported to... make the foreign policy that he needs for the survival of his country and the revolution in it. And, you know, when you talk about I think the left has to defend the revolution in other countries in the world. China is still a product of a revolution that took place in 1949. And that was a revolution that broke with the capitalist system. They've never really been forgiven for it, even though now they're allowing the United States to invest heavily in China and repatriate profits, but they're also building up their country in that way. And the United States already tried to overthrow Chavez once. They had a coup. They'll try it again. And they keep trying again and again until...
Right, but that's sort of a different question. That's sort of a different question. We understand the U.S. is trying to destabilize Venezuela, but it's sort of a different question. Nicholas, do you have a response for our caller?
I certainly respect Venezuela. Respect Venezuela's right to have its own sovereign foreign policy, but I also reserve my own right to disagree with Chavez's decision to back the Chinese crackdown on Tibet. I just have a serious moral problem with that. I think China is a human rights nightmare. I don't think China today has much resemblance to the Chinese Revolution of 1949. In my article, I talk about the horrendous labor climate in China, you know, including strike breakers and killing of labor activists. And so it's perplexing why Chavez would go out of his way to praise the Chinese government. He may think that, look, I got to ship oil to China, and maybe I'm not an energy expert, and so maybe it would be difficult for Venezuela to ship oil to other countries outside of the U.S. And, you know, have a turn of profit. And so maybe he thinks he has to ship oil to China, but he doesn't need to go out of his way and with the complimentary rhetoric towards the crackdown of the Tibetans.
Okay, and with that, we have two people calling in. Can we get another? 212-209-2900. Anybody wishes to discuss this question or anything else we've been speaking about this evening with Nicholas Kozloff, author of Revolution, South America and the Rise of the New Left. The number is 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello?
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 You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to know, in terms of Venezuela, Chavez with the Petric Caribe, did that ever take off? You have any information about that?
I think there's the caller's referring to Chavez oil diplomacy in the Caribbean. And the answer to your question is, yeah, I mean, Chavez has been able to extend his geopolitical influence in the Caribbean. For example, as I talked about before, there's this small island called Dominica, which is run by a very young prime minister named Roosevelt Skerrit, who's a progressive. And Dominica now is receiving, I think, oil at discounted prices. I think that Chavez is trying to get smaller Caribbean islands on board. I think that this is a little dicey, though, in terms of local politics on the island, because I think some people may fear that, well, if Dominica allies too close to Venezuela, then this could be like another Grenada in 1982, which we certainly wouldn't want. And I actually published a whole article about this in the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, which is a think tank based in Washington, D.C. And when I suggested, when I even made the comparison to Grenada, the right wing in Dominica jumped on my report saying, look, Roosevelt Skerrit, this is exactly what is going to happen if we ally too closely to Venezuela. And this is what they're saying in the United States about us. And so that was an example of my articles actually being used in a way that I really didn't want. But yes, you're right. I think that certainly in terms of Cuba and some of these smaller islands, Dominica, Chavez has been able to get some diplomatic support. But again, going back to my my points earlier, whether or not he can piece together a coalition of these smaller countries and then make such a huge difference, I have my doubts. I think despite, you know, this book that I just read, I think Chavez certainly has extended his influence, but I think we may be seeing a kind of ceiling on that right now. He's certainly been able to gain adherence amongst the smaller countries, but there may be a limit.
Okay, thank you very much for your caller, sir, for your call. The number is 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, if anybody has further questions or comments. For Nicholas Kozloff, author of Revolution, South America and the Rise of the New Left. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, Viva Chavez, long live the People's Republic of China. The Dalai Lama was a slave owner. He owned thousands of slaves for many years. You'll never hear this on BAI because Tony Riddle worked as a professional anti-communist in Eastern Europe. And BAI is becoming more and more anti-communist. You hate real socialism. And that's who you really are. You're BAI-CIA. Long live the People's Republic of China. Defend the Olympic
Court. Okay, well, look, I'm not getting any money from the CIA. I'm not getting any money from any foundations. I'm a struggling writer, okay? Now, it may be inconvenient for you to believe that I have arrived at my analysis independently, but unfortunately, it happens to be the case. And, you know, I would just question, well, before I ask my question, Nicholas, do you have a response for our caller?
I would just reiterate what I already said. I don't necessarily identify China of 2008 with the People's Republic of China. I just reserve the right to, have my own commentary. And I, while I applaud many of Chavez's accomplishments, I have serious disagreement. And, I don't think that makes me a stooge of U.S. imperialism. Or furthering United States agenda. In fact, I've spoken out through two books and, you know, on the right-wing media circuit and the progressive media circuit against U.S. imperialism. But I think that, the left, should be, should have debates about relevant political matters, and maybe that's what distinguishes the left from the right, which kind of falls into lockstep around Bush, and hopefully the left can have a more thoughtful debate about these questions.
Okay, and I don't know if the caller is still listening, but just for the benefit of people out there who are listening and might be confused by some of what he said, you know, I want to make clear that I'm not opposed to the so-called People's Republic of China because I'm anti-communist. I'm opposed to the so-called People's Republic of China because I'm anti-capitalist. And the contemporary People's Republic of China is a, you know, it's brutally, savagely capitalist. And you've got, you know, repression against labor activists, repression against environmentalists, you know, breakneck exploitation of resources, shanty towns around the cities in the northern industrial belt. I mean, if you take a look at what just happened around the earthquake, where there was that village in Sichuan, where the school building immediately collapsed and killed all the kids who were in their classes, whereas the new hotels which had been built for the tourists did not collapse because they cut corners on building the school in order to save money to build nice big luxury hotels for the tourists. This is what you call socialism? If this is what you call socialism, you can keep it. This is not socialism. This is the most brutal, oppressive capitalism imaginable. WBAI, you're on the air. No, you're not. Okay. WBAI, you're on the air. I mean, you can't just live in a 1949 time warp, okay? It's like, it's 2008, okay? And if you're just gonna, you know, get all of your information, 100% of your information from reading, you know, Workers' World, then you're not gonna know what's going on in the world, okay? WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello, yes. Hello?
Hello.
Yes, I just had a couple of things that I just wanted to say about the, that, yeah, we are criticizing China, we are criticizing other countries, but even here in our country, we are having the similar problems, so to speak. We have people that can't go on strike, they have Taylor Law here, you know, the construction mishaps that happened in Manhattan and stuff. I mean, they're cutting corners and stuff, not paying enough. I mean, it's a similar situation, you know, here as well. You know, before we go abroad and start looking at other people in probably other countries and stuff, I think we should, so to speak, you know, we should at least pay somewhat attention over here as well.
Okay, but this is WBAI. This is WBAI. We don't relentlessly pay attention to questions of social injustice within our own borders.
Right, in here, in our country, here.
Yes.
We are also having some sort of problems, like, similar to, you know, labor and stuff like that.
Right, exactly. But we've never denied that.
Right, but are they going to do anything about it? Or
who is they?
I mean, the government. What else? Who else is going to do anything about
it? Well, hang on a minute. But I'm not in the government, okay? And, you know, I mean, our role as media commentators and social activists and so on is to raise the alarm about the, you know, the social injustices which exist within our own borders and about the shoddy workmanship which is going on in the, you know, the building construction sites of Manhattan Island and et cetera. But does this, you know, demand that we have to be silent about the parallel abuses which take place in China? And if that's the case, does that also mean we should be silent about the parallel abuses which take place in Colombia or Guatemala or U.S. client states? And I'm not following your logic here.
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we should pay some sort of attention over here as well, because we are losing our grip as well over here. It's coming to be the same thing as what you see in China, you know, with you know, the school collapse because of construction wasn't done right. What do you think is happening here? I mean, they're cutting corners here.
Yeah, but you're making the same point over and over again. Yeah, we acknowledge. Hang on a minute, man. Please listen. We acknowledge and WBAI, it's raison d'être, okay? The reason WBAI exists is to call out, you know, the social injustices which take place within our own city and within our own country. But does doing so mean that we have to be silent about the social injustices which are taking place in China? This is the question I want you to address.
I don't think we should be silent about any social injustice anywhere else, but we also look at our country as well. We are not perfect. You know, we have problems.
But nobody here is saying the United States is perfect. I mean, if you got that from listening to this program, that we're saying that the United States is perfect, then I don't know. I think you've been listening with a jaundiced ear, shall we say.
No, I just want to make a comment on that because I see problem here, and I don't know if anybody else, nobody has talked about it, on any other radio. So I just want to put a point out there.
Okay, I shouldn't have. I'm sorry, Nicholas. Do you have any response for our caller?
I think I would just say similar things along the lines of what you remarked. I think that there are labor abuses in New York City, as evidenced by the recent accidents on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. That said, I think China is far worse than New York. In China, if you go out on strike, you can get, they call out strike breakers, and you can't form an independent union. There are no forms of labor redress. So I'm not denying the caller's comments about labor abuse in the U.S., but I think China's worse.
Okay, let's see. Well, once again, predictably, the board lights up when we only have 5 minutes to go. So let's see how many calls we can squeeze in. WBAI, you're on the air. You're not. WBAI, you're on the air.
Imperialist running dogs, that's all you are, BAICI.
Did you listen to anything that we said? I mean, do you really think that after everything we said that... Why are you just, like, spouting these slogans instead of trying to actually think about what we're saying?
You're very clever anti-communist. That's all you...
No. I'm anti-capitalist. I oppose China because I'm anti-capitalist.
China, but you won't fight in it. You're a bunch of petty bourgeois dilettantes. You hate the working class. You hate real socialism.
No. It's the Chinese ruling elites in Beijing who hate the ruling class and hate real socialism. You know, you should, like, figure out what's going on in the world, man. You can't get all your information from the workers' world newspaper. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi, so,
turn down your radio. Turn down your radio. Please turn down your radio. Okay.
All right.
You there?
Yes, sir. I'm...
Hello?
Hello?
Speak.
Yes, sir. I'm a Tibetan, right?
I'm sorry?
So, I am a Tibetan.
Oh, yes.
Hold a second.
Mm-hmm. I believe we have a Tibetan caller.
I'm a Tibetan, and I'm listening to this program. Hello?
Yes, please go on, sir.
And the one of the caller, he said that Dalai Lama was just, he held so many slaves like that, right?
Yes.
And I think this is totally incorrect. Being a Tibetan who was born in Tibet and came to India, I think this caller is totally wrong, because Dalai Lama never kept any slaves. By the way, even if he kept any slaves, any country it's happened, look at China. Their own leader, Mao Zedong, he killed 30 million of people. What about that? Dalai Lama never killed any people. Tibetan administration never killed any people. But look at China now. Right now, Tibet is totally closed from outside world. Nobody can say anything about it. This guy, he has no idea what is happening in Tibet. And also, the Hugo Chavez, what he said is like, he is totally, he's outrageous, his objective is totally, blinded by money or greed, that he can make from China. And now look at America. Right now I'm calling and I'm just able to express my viewpoint. But if this guy is in China, and if he says something against Chinese government, he will be dead tomorrow, He has no idea what he is saying and what he is saying to you guys. This is a great program. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. Thank you very much for your call, sir. Any responses, or should we go on to the next call?
No, we can go on.
Okay. I should note, by the way, once again, the board is lit up. I really appeal to the listeners because this seems to be our dynamic. You have to get into the habit of calling in earlier. When we first announce at the at 1 o'clock in the morning, which is usually when we make the announcement that we're going to take phone calls, call in then. Don't wait until we only have 3 minutes on the air to make your call. WBAI, you're on the air. Make it quick because we don't have much time.
Why don't you play more Dinah Shore?
I'm sorry. All right, please don't waste our time. Come on, WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Real quick. I just wanted to let you know that everything that's being said, we're all being blindsided by what are the real problems in society. There's this film out there. It's called ZeitgeistMovie.com. watch it, and we'll see what we... Hold on, let me turn off the radio.
We're going to turn you off, buddy. Sorry. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi there. I'd like to ask a quick question of your guest regarding Chavez, and I think one of his biggest blunders was the way he handled the Channel 2 situation in Caracas, where he took the entire TV station off the air, which provided a lot of culturally iconic novellas, soap operas to the people down there. And I was wondering if there wasn't a way that he could have handled that differently by maybe taking away the station's news department or even nationalizing the station and keeping the entertainment programming and just getting rid of the political propaganda. So that's my question, because that's always fascinated me as like a big media blunder.
Okay, all right. Nicholas?
I'm not sure exactly what channel two corresponds
RCTV,
to.
RCTV, I assume, right?
Oh, okay. Well, if it's the RCTV, that actually, it wasn't that he took the station off the air. I think he didn't renew the broadcast license, and then they were broadcasting on certain parts of the country, maybe not in other areas. I have some mixed feelings about this. You know, in the United States, you can't just get on the airwaves and say down with the Bush regime. The FCC probably has regulations against that.
Well, I mean, actually, we do that on BAI all the time. I'll say it right now: down with the Bush regime. Okay, no problem.
I don't know what the actual laws are, but. We're talking about media outlets that basically were involved in orchestrating a coup, or at least encouraging it. Is it a political move to not renew their license, or is it just a legal move? They were violating the terms of their agreement. I do think that... there are legitimate issues to be raised. I certainly hope that the media maintains a semblance of independence in Venezuela. On certain TV stations like Venezolana de Televisión, which is Channel 8, that's pretty much pro-Chavez, and they're just scurrilously insulting the opposition night after night. Some of the other... state-sponsored media have shown a bit more independence. I certainly hope that Chavez doesn't interfere in their affairs. Personally, I'm not. I don't necessarily think that state media is necessarily bad as long as it can be independent. For example, in Britain, you have the BBC. It's not always so independent, but it's probably more independent than most of our media. The PBS is partially state funded in the U.S. and it's more independent than the corporate media. So the fact that it's state funded gives me pause, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's overt intervention. And I have a whole chapter in my book about this. I interviewed the head of Telesur, which is a news station which is run by Argentina, Uruguay, Cuba, and Venezuela. And I interviewed the director, and he flatly denied that it was anti-U.S. network or pro-Venezuela and that it was independent. I certainly hope that that continues to be the case.
All right. Should we try to squeeze in one last call? Let's hope that it's a good one. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, quickly. There can be capitalism with a human face. If the microcredit revolution in Bangladesh has relevance to South America, maybe we shouldn't try to pattern South America on the economy of North Korea or East Germany.
I don't think that's what Chavez is trying to do. Nick?
I don't know much about Bangladesh. I'm a little confused.
Right, but certainly I don't think that Chavez's model is North Korea. That sounds rather overstated, wouldn't you say?
I would not compare the two. Even though Chavez brands himself a socialist, capitalism is still prevalent in Venezuela. The oil companies are there, and so there are some socialistic programs, but it's not a socialistic economy.
Okay, well, since our call was a bit of a dodge, we try to squeeze in one last call and hope for the best, and then we really do have to be off the air. WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air.
Hi. You know what I heard long ago is that it's one step backwards, two steps forwards, and you may not be stooges, but you're lackeys.
For whom?
Obviously for the U.S. Imperialist goal.
Why? Because we think that Tibetans are entitled to human rights?
No, Tibetans are trying to get a Dalai Lama back who is a feudal master, and they're basically...
Okay, so supposing that's true. Supposing they're trying to get the Dalai Lama back who's a feudal master, that means that they're not entitled to human rights?
No, they have their human rights. Where are more people locked up in prison, the U.S. or China?
Well, actually,
okay.
The U.S.
They indulge in self-criticism in China.
Look, you really need to go check out the Amnesty International reports on Tibet. That's all I can say. Okay, with that...
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.